Minded Podcast, powered by the CDA Paris Edition, presented by Maison et Objet and Paris Design Week.
How are we doing today, Anna?
Great. It's a little warm.
It is very warm.
But we're not going to, in Paris we complain a lot, so we're not going to complain, right? We're going to say this is really great. because we had a kind of a very funny summer, so it's nice. It's nice.
Good. Well, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Here we are, day one, Paris Design Week.
Yes.
Yes. What are you looking for the most?
Well, I think I'm looking for the new things that are coming out of this season. I think there's going to be some amazing events happening with the Invisible Collection, with Véronèse. This lady that I just work and really appreciate, her name is Cécile Mugler. Mm. She does colors. She's a colorist. She's having a presentation. Of course, brands that I work with like Taiping are doing things. Alain Elouz, who's the master of Alabaster, he's opening up his gallery, in fact, tonight, since that's going to be the big kickoff.
Exciting. The city's about to start getting crowded and busy.
Yeah, I think so. But it's great. It's great.
Do you remember your first time in Paris with Design Week?
No, you know, it's very funny because Paris Design Week has been happening for many, many years. Mm-hmm. But I think it's been this sort of very slow crescendo. And I think within the last, say, 3 to 4, because there's the COVID break, right? So we won't talk about that. But in the last 3-4 years, it's really sort of taken off. Before, it was something that happened. We went to a few events, but it didn't have the same energy. I mean, really, I don't know if you felt, but really right now in the city, you can feel this incredible design energy. All of the shops, all of the suppliers are popping. They're sending out flyers, sending out announcements. So this, I think it's really going to be a great turnout this year.
What would be the difference if you were to compare between what's going on right now in September and what they have in January for like the co-off? For people who are not familiar, but they have heard about both.
Well, I think, you know, Dickoff is a little bit more fabric-oriented, mm-hmm. in my sense, right? I mean, they're two very different events. I think what's great about both events is that they really bring together the design community, not only the local design community, but also the international design community. And I think that's very important for Paris, because for me, Paris is a sort of, it's a very significant design hub. You know, we always think of Milan, but, you know, watch out, Paris is where they... We're going for number one.
There you go. I love that.
It's true.
Now, you've been in Paris for a few years now.
A few years now. Let's not count numbers. But
we're not doing the math. But tell me a little bit how it was for you moving as a young profession to Paris in a time that I don't believe there were any Americans here.
Well, there were not a lot of American designers, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And it was a period I was 26, 27.
Just yesterday.
Yesterday. It was, for me, it was a move that was without option, which is to say, I had finished my studies, had worked again for a couple years back in LA, for a great firm, Arthur Erickson Architects, a Canadian guy, and I discovered the work of Andre Putman. And I had always had a project to move to Paris, mm-hmm. since I was about 15 years old. And I was at a point in my career in Los Angeles where I had been there for a couple of years. I wanted to change. And I had a few options. And I thought, well, you know, might as well think about the Paris option. And then I discovered the work of Andre Putman, and it all became clear. And so I came with that as an objective. One-way ticket, you know, my bags in a case, and a telephone number. And I called.
So at that point, did you reach out before you made it to Paris? Were you waiting until you got here to have opportunity?
Well, I met her at, she gave a presentation at West Week. That might have been March of that year. And I briefly met her, you know, mm-hmm. in meet and greet. There were tons of people around. And, you know, she was very kind and said, like, I can't speak to you, but if you ever come to Paris, you know, call me up. I, of course, thought I had a job, but, you know, it's not how it works. So I had her number, and I just called, and it, you know, it took me a while.
What was the first time that you had the opportunity to be in front of her and spare a few minutes talking to her?
That, well, besides the moment at West Week, I didn't meet up with her again until August of 87.
Okay.
But I called her office every day, 5 days a week, between April when I arrived and August when I finally met her. Because it was a sort of what I call a take no prisoners scenario. I mean, really, and you know this, if you're passionate about something, if you want something, if you have an objective, you just keep pushing and you keep pushing and you keep pushing and you keep pushing.
Isn't that the American you? And more mentality?
I think it's anybody who's passionate about anything has that mentality, you know. Maybe it's American, I don't think so. Because I know a lot of Europeans get crazy passionate about things and just don't let up. And I think, you know, people, if I think what I try to tell the younger associates in my office and even when I've, the few moments that I taught, you know, if you're not, we have this chance to do something that we love, right? And we've been given this gift that we've crafted and we've honed. Mm-hmm. And if we aren't passionate about what it is we are doing, then you should really go do something else. Because the worst thing you can do in life is do something halfway. We have a limited amount of time here. And the only way to do something is to go full out and really, really with all your heart. Now, sometimes you're going to hit the wall.
Yes. Right?
Maybe you're going to hit the wall many times. And I've hit the wall many times. But you still get up and you keep going because you have that passion. And it will take you even beyond what you imagined in life. You know?
Does that happen to you like right now? If you look back and have the opportunity to meet yourself when you just arrived at Paris back in the late 80s, you know, would that person feel like, yes, this is exactly what I hope it accomplished?
No, I think this, I never imagined this scenario for sure. I had imagined that I would move to Paris and I would work with Andre for a certain number of years. Maybe it was 1 year, I don't remember now, but, and then I would go back to the United States and sort of, you know, pick up my career and do that. But when I moved here, I really felt calmed, curious, intrigued. And so I just kept going, you know, and one thing led to another. And I was with her 10 years at Ecar. And when she sold Ecar, she started a new office and asked me to be her partner. And so I was the, you know, the managing design director of that office, working really directly with her and then managing all of the teams that we had. And then out of the blue, an opportunity occurred for me to go off on my own. And it was not something that I sought out, right? But the opportunity was really lovely. And so we stopped collaborating, Andre and I, and I went off and started my own shop. And then you start doing that, right? And then at some point, I think it was now 2008, I get a call from the director of communications of Ruinart, who says, look, we'd like you to make a proposal to redo our site in Haas, which is the oldest champagne house in the world, 1729. And you say, okay, and then that, and then boom, and you start going. And then after that, Bicard Salmon calls me to do something. And then we just did a really nice project with Christophe. So these are all incredibly important French houses, whether it's, you know, wine and spirits or design, like these are Orfèvrerie of Christophe. And if I would, if you had said to me in 1989 or 1980, oh, Elliot, you know, would you imagine working for Rina? I think, well, probably no, never. So I think I've been very, very fortunate. And I never really expected that this would sort of all come together this way.
You were at that point almost checking the boxes of your goal, right? You're in Paris, a manager partner with the person you want to work with. But you just took the chance on something new. Something maybe a little scary at the point, at the time.
Totally scary. But you know, I left everything that I knew and everything that was secure to me in 1987 to move here with no job, no place to live, and only, you know, the address of a friend of mine's parents. They very nicely took me in for a couple of weeks so I could get my feet settled and find a place. So. And I was driven by this sort of gut feeling that I knew that if I didn't take that chance, I would regret it all my life. And that's unfortunate. And I'm really not in that frame of mind where you need to regret. You can try to do something and it might not work, but at least you tried to do that. The worst thing I think we can do in life is to have a dream to do something and not step up to that dream. that is kind of a waste. So when I had this chance, I guess it was 2003, 2004, to start the office, I didn't really know where we were going. I started on the dining room table at the apartment. My ex-wife said, look, you know, the dining room table is yours from 9 until 6 when I get home. Then it's family life.
Dinner time.
Dinner time. Take care of the son. So, and then you just go and you figure it out. You know? And I'm not afraid. And I've never been afraid. Sometimes I've made wrong decisions, right? That's okay. But I've never been afraid to try. And, you know, my dad said something to me a long time ago. He said, you know, what's important in life is to want to and to try. And if you want to and you will try, you'll get through. Maybe not today, but you'll get through.
Is your father with us still?
No, he passed away in 2015.
But he got a chance to see you.
Yes. He came over a few times. He and my mom came over a few times. That was very nice.
Tell me a little bit about upbringing. How was it for you growing up in the U.S. with your father and your mom? Some of the, you know, the thing kind of stand out. Those memories that you treasured most.
Long time ago, you know. Yeah, my dad was a doctor. My mother was a school teacher. And I was always involved in all kinds of activities, you know, painting, drawing, dancing, music, swimming classes, diving classes, all kinds of things. You know, it was a very sort of bourgeois upbringing, you know, very strict. You know, no TV. And the message was always study, 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 work, work, work. So that kind of gave me a certain orientation, you know. I think the art side of me carried me to do architecture. And then in high school, I knew I wanted to be an architect. And my dad said, well, you should probably go to liberal arts school, you know. And I said, no, I really want to be an architect. And I found a program at Cornell that took kids right out of high school into architecture on day one. I applied, they accepted me. I didn't visit the school. I didn't know anybody there. I packed up my things and I'll never forget. My dad said, look, you know, I will pay for you to go anywhere you want to for school, but you cannot go to the school within 100-mile radius of this house. Get out, go live your life, have fun. It's the last time that you can be irresponsible, but do not stay close to home. And when you go, do not call, because go live your life. I thought, okay, that's fine. My mother was a little shaken. And I remember putting my things into my trunk, and I had all my gear that I'd purchased, my drawing things and folded things. My dad came in and he said, you know, that's not how you fold a shirt. This is how you fold a shirt. It's the last time I'll fold your shirt. But he took everything out of my trunk, folded everything, put it back in, and sent me away, put me on a plane. And that was it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I left with that, right?
Now you are a father yourself.
Yes.
Yes. Some of the, what do you try to, not copy, but what do you try to, lessons from your dad that you want to pass along to your son?
Independence. Stand on your own 2 feet. Decide for yourself. Try. Never give up. And as a father, I tell my friends who are also fathers, I think one of the things I try to do is to not, you know, to sort through the bags that our parents have given us, or at least me, and not give the same bags, right? So you kind of want to read down the process and give a child enough room to express themselves, but teach a child respect. You know, my son is not my friend. I'm his dad. He's my son. Point. I'm not one of these progressive fathers that says, oh, you know, let's go have a beer. Even though I will have a cocktail with my son every now and then. But, yes, you know, it's still very much of a father-son kind of relationship. And I think that's very important to maintain.
That's very interesting. My father, myself, 2 little girls. But I kind of shared the same sentiment with you. I'm your father first and foremost.
Yeah.
And I was Ruby.
Yeah.
You know, I think a 10-year-old, and she called, bro, I'm like, I'm not your friend.
That's cut out right there. That's right, exactly. Like, that's we can share a lot of great moments,
yes,
right?
That's not it. That's not one of them.
Yeah, I know.
But for me, it's always interesting to hear, because you start seeing traits of personality from creative people upbringing. And a lot of time comes when fathers and parents that are very supportive, but also give them an opportunity to fail or to take chances.
Exactly. I think it's very important for a child to fail. Mm-hmm. I think it's part of the process, because in life, we will fail, right? But what counts is how you get up and you put it back together and you move forward. And if we're so protective of our children that we don't allow them that chance, when they get out and they do hit that wall, it's going to be a big mess. And I've seen it, you know. And I'm not trying to sort of, you know, paint them my father, you know, father sort of knows best type of scenario. And yes. Everybody raises their child as they choose, and that's their prerogative. But my personal belief is that we are there to encourage our kids, but most certainly to teach them independence. You know, figure it out first. Call me only if you need me. Don't call me first.
The idea of feeling setbacks, let's put it that way. How do you manage those when it comes to you? I'm sure it's different how you used to back in the day and how it is right now, as you know, you get more confident with your skills and your abilities. Are you someone who dwell on it, think about it, analyze it, or just turn the page and move on?
Well, I don't sleep, you know. Sometimes it eats at you. That's part of the process. You know, when you're living, what I tell the people in the office, the kids in the office, that it's important to live a project. Mm-hmm. To live a project means that you what I say, quote unquote, you sweat the details. That means it's on your mind all the time. You're worried about how things go together. You're worried about if this person got the right information, if you gave the right information, mm-hmm. if they've interpreted it in the correct way. And when you have a setback, you take the hit. I usually leave the office and walk. And somehow when I walk around Paris, things lighten up and I have a different perspective. And then I know where I can take the next step forward.
You have an opportunity to collaborate with some amazing brands in mm-hmm. heritage companies, as you mentioned before. What are the things that you're looking for in terms of those opportunities and collaborations? I'm sure at this point you can choose. You're not going to jump on any project because there's a part of you, you're giving away your time, your resource, your creativity to those projects. What are you looking for before you can agree to jump in a new project like this?
I think what really turns me on in a project, especially when you're working with sort of heritage brands, is the message that they want to give. And for me, that has to do with authenticity and being true to what their core values, that's been used and overused, but being true to their identity. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't really set up a lot of objectives when I go in. I try to go in with a clean slate, to be very open, to hear what they have to say, to see what we can do together. But I want to make sure that when we start a project, they want to go all the way. What would turn me off is to say, oh, you know, we'd like to do this, but we can't. If you can't start a project that way. Mm-hmm. You know? We haven't even exchanged words yet. We haven't even exchanged ideas, haven't exchanged emotions, and you've already put up barriers. I like people to go in and say, look, you know, we want to do this. Let's talk about the possibilities. Mm. Because at the end of the day, and I've said this a couple times before, I see my job, the end result of my job, as a sort of design of possibilities, right? So that means that you create a space that has a certain presence, but also gives a certain space for people to evolve in, to appropriate that space, to make it their own. So I'm really designing a sort of canvas upon which the moments of the day can happen. So it's really about creating possibilities. And you can only do that if everyone is open coming to the table.
Do you have a preference in terms of developing products or working in the interior in a project with a new home or something like that?
No, I enjoy interiors a lot because I enjoy form, I enjoy space. But I'm designing more and more objects as things go on. I mean, the experience designing Philippe's for Christophe was a beautiful experience. Working with that house that's been around for 200 years, working with craftsmen that have been honing their craft for 35, 40 years, learning about their process, how you can take a sheet of sterling silver and really de-stress it and form it into something else. And working with other, I designed a humidor. Mm. Just because I'm a sort of occasional cigar fan, I thought I might design it. So just learning about that, developing into different subjects, that's really very interesting to me. So I think as I move on more and more, I'm more attracted to objects.
What else do you have going on in the next couple of months?
Oh, okay.
I know you have a lineup of things coming up.
Yeah, there's a few things happening. So one major event, and I think what's major about it is not the Tiber project, but the location, is I was commissioned by the Jewish Museum in New York to design the installation for an exhibition called The Mood of the Moment, Gabi Aguillon and the House of Chloé. And Gabi Aguillon was the founder of Chloé back in 1954, 1956. And this is a retrospective of her work and about her life. And so it's my first project in New York and my first project in America under my own name. And so this will open on October the 13th and run through February 2024. So that's a big moment yes. for us. So really looking forward to that. I'll be going to New York beginning of October. And then a major event happening in 2024 is one, first we'll celebrate the 20 years of my office, Elliott Barnes Interiors. That will be a nice moment. And at the same time, we'll be finishing a project for Bicar Salmon, which is a visitors and reception center, wine tasting center, at their house in Marais-sur-Ailly. And that's going to be a very important moment for us. So champagne.
A lot of champagne.
A lot of champagne.
Tell about the emotions of having your first work in New York being such a significant one. I mean, as you mentioned, after almost 20 years in with your own firm.
Well, yeah, I think again, it happened out of the blue. The project director, Claudia Gould, I've known her for about, I don't know, 30 years. We did an exhibition together with Andre at the Wexner Center called The Little Black Dress. And she just called me out of the blue for this. I didn't really, you know, search this out. And I really appreciate her energy and all the things that she brings to a project and her her point of view. And it was something that you can't say no. I mean, the Jewish Museum, which is an incredible institution, super, super important institution. And again, it was, these are the garments, these are the spaces. Come back with the project. And which is what we did. And then we worked through it with the museum staff and, you know, learned a lot about installation, because I'd never really done an installation of this nature by myself. And it's a rather, it's a difficult undertaking because there are questions of light. The garments are fragile sometimes. There are lending rules. There are accessibility issues, especially, you know, in America. So you have to bring together a lot of logistical, practical, and technical constraints and still make it beautiful, sort of a beautiful project. So I think I'm pretty confident we hit this one on the head. You know, kind of what you say, what you think, what the public will think, but it's going to be a really great moment, really great place.
Do you think about, like, not the criticism but the feedback when you talk to me, something you mentioned, how the public is going to react to something like this when you're working with the presenting a new project to someone, for a client? Are you not anxious, but you're very much kind of wondering about how you deal with those feedbacks?
Well, you know, I have stage fright and I'm not an actor. And before each presentation, there is angst.
Little butterflies.
Yeah, big butterflies sometimes, you know. But I think that's positive energy because you're never sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I know what I'm doing. I have a pretty good idea. Really, I know what I'm doing. But you're never sure if the message that you're trying to communicate will be understood. Because usually when someone comes in and says, you know, this is the brief, go away, come back, there's not usually a lot of interchange. And they want to give you the space to come back with ideas. So you always hope that your ideas are going to be on the spot, please. Usually they are, but each one needs to be fine-tuned. And I think that's a very important point. I think this idea of carte blanche that says, oh, someone gave me carte blanche, I mean, it's completely fake. Carte blanche does not exist. Everybody has a need. Everybody has a program. And it's our job as a designer to respond to that need, to respond to that program. Now, of course, we have carte blanche in the sense that they aren't going to draw it for us. And it's up to us, the designers, the creators, to propose something. But we operate within a framework, whether it's time, budget, program, whatever. So with when you take all that in and you come back to make a proposal, yeah, you're never sure. You know, and I think it's good to not be sure, because when you're not sure, you're open to suggestions, to comments. And it's what I say to people, and I say to the kids in the office, is that the comments are not about us. It's about the project. So take your ego out of it.
That's interesting.
Leave your ego at the door.
Yeah.
The only thing that's important is the project. And I have a very sort of horizontal office, and I have interns, and I say to you, so what do you think? And sort of petrified.
They want to see their own thing.
Yeah, you can have an idea, and I'm interested to know what you think.
Yeah.
Because the only thing that's important is the project. So, you know, we just sort of need to step back and put the project before us, because that's the thing that will be around for the longest time.
Now, as you're getting ready to celebrate 20 years with your own firm next year, and you have crossed so many boxes of goals and objectives, from moving to Paris, working with Andre, and now this, what else do you feel like you want to accomplish? I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of goals, but any big one that you'd like to share?
What would be the next thing that I'd like to accomplish? Well, I'd like to give a hand at, I'd like to design a church, you know? I like to get that more perhaps metaphysical area of things. I like to explore that, and just continue to do more research with materials, really address notions of sustainability, recycling. Now there's we've seen this in the press and even in work. There's a real change in the entire industry that really people are exploring materials and pushing that a little bit more. So that's very interesting for me. I'd probably do an art gallery or a museum. That'd be fun. You know, art is very much part of what I do.
The church, I'm curious about it. You don't need a chance if you don't feel comfortable. Are you a religious person, a spiritual person?
Spiritual. Mm-hmm. Religious, probably not. But I come from a Southern Baptist background.
Okay.
And I did go to Sunday school and church with my mother every Sunday. But I'm not a religious person. But I am spiritual. But I think, and what interests me about working at church is the relationship between form, space, and light.
Mm.
And those three elements, form, space, and light, have always been kind of at the core of what I do. You know, and you draw, of course, you throw materials, but form, space, and light are really, really important.
I love it. Now, before we finish this, I'm going to do a quick this or that.
Uh-oh.
And it's a little trouble.
Okay.
You know. And you can tell me, and it's not really this or that, a couple of questions you can tell me. Short answers, if you may. All right. Let's go. A guilty pleasure.
Guilty pleasure?
Yes.
A Romeo and Juliet wide Winston Churchill cigar on a Sunday afternoon.
A person you like to take a place with. You'd like to take a place with for a day. Trade a place.
A person like to trade a place with for a day? Wow. Anyone?
Anyone? Anyone in history?
Anyone in history?
Yeah, whatever. Go wild.
Go wild? maybe trade a place with Martin Luther King for a day.
Hmm.
That's an important moment. History?
For sure.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. See what that was like.
Best compliment you ever got?
Best compliment I ever got. And I don't know what it is verbatim, but it was something to do with, you know, we love your design so much. It was if it had been there all the time.
Mm.
And I like that because it means that you've been able to design something, you've entered a sort of continuum and just part of the flow, and they enjoy it, and you can reorient and change things, but you don't shock.
I like that. That's a nice one.
Mm.
Something you wish you were better at.
Something I wish I was bad at?
Better.
Better. Everything.
Come on. I don't know.
I have tons of room to grow. I need to be better at everything.
A book. We always ask everybody who's in the podcast to recommend us a book, something to read. Give me a couple. Doesn't give me one specific.
God. you know, a book. So this is a very niche book, but it's a book that was very, that is still very important in my life. It's called A Collage City by Colin Rowe and Fred Coder.
Okay.
That's a super important book. What is another important book? Another important book for me, this is again wild, was the autobiography of Miles Davis. That was a super important book.
How old were you when you first read it?
I was old, probably like, you know, 31. And another important book, which probably changed my life when I read it when I was 15, was A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway. And that's a pretty important book for me.
Did you realize as soon as you finished that this book kind of just not changed my life, but blow you away, like right off the bat?
It, yeah, it gave me a very clear visualization of Paris. And I think that was the spark.
Mm. It started.
Yeah. And in relationship between him and the artists and Gertrude Stein and the writers and that the entire energy of that period, the entire creative energy of that period. And I've had moments now, because I'm working on a personal art collection documenting members of my family with work done by only artists from the African diaspora. And because I've been working on this project for a few years, I have these sort of movable feast moments where I find myself in a room with a lot of really incredible artists from the African diaspora at a dinner or at a cocktail. And I have this sort of step back moment where I think, oh, this is just like in the book. Mm. So that book was actually pretty important to me.
What about a movie?
TV
show as well.
TV show, not the TV show guy. A movie. Gosh, you know, I haven't been in movies in a long, long time, unfortunately. I don't know. You know, I think a movie that I really liked when I was a child was The Red Balloon. I remember being 6 years old at the Lycée Français in Los Angeles and watching this movie, this Red Balloon, just sort of going, it was very poetic. It was a really beautiful little movie.
And a guest, who should we invite to be a guest in the next podcast?
Ini Archibong.
Well, yeah.
He's a great designer.
We love Ini.
Yeah, I love Ini.
Yeah, Ini is so funny. Yeah. I mean, it's a small world.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we all cross paths.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's probably, you know, running around with his kid, doing his thing. I'm sure he's here somewhere.
He's here somewhere, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Ini's a great guy.
We were lucky he presented one of the awards for us in January. Mm. And one of those guys, too, who really, like you, dedicated their life to their craft, a very invested on the work, but also in their family, you know. And I mean, we had the opportunity to, you know, met before, but never really spend time like we had today.
Yeah.
And for me, to have the opportunity to not only spend time with a person who I admire as an artist and as an architect, but to get to know you a little bit more and your background, your stories of, as your father and your son, it just goes back to the how life, you got to treasure those little moments, right?
Exactly.
You know, exactly. And that's the whole purpose of we decided to pursue this idea with the minded. Was often I find myself in the presence of amazing, great people, and those conversations are all phenomenal, but it's just mine. Mm. And I love it. I have those moments to treasure, but I want to share.
Mm.
And we just turn the camera on a little bit for an hour so people can, you know, have a glimpse of you and
thank
everything
you.
You're doing. We're incredibly proud to have you with us, and I thank you so much for taking
time. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much. Wonderful interview. You asked me questions that really, you know, no one has ever asked me before, and what I find interesting about that is that it shows that we do not operate within a design vacuum, and that all of these life experiences really participate to help us, you know, with our craft and move forward.
Exactly, sir.
Great.
Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Experience the world of art, design, and culture through Minded Podcast. Engage with groundbreaking artists, visionary designers, and cultural influencers, and delve into their creative processes. Minded Podcast, powered by the CDA. New episodes every Tuesday.